Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Two deadly mass shootings last weekend put the debate over guns and gun control legislation front and center once again.
A lot of legislation, much of it very thoughtful. Legislation is not far left, is not far right. It's just good practical legislation.
We talk to local lawmakers about what they think should be done when it comes to guns. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine a potential state buyout of some homeowners near the Port of Wilmington, struggling to cope with industrial neighbors. And learn more about what the escalating trade war between the U.S. and China could mean when you go shopping. Plus, Arts Playlist previews the new Delaware Symphony Orchestra season, and Enlighten Me focuses on the new Wilmington Alliance and its hopes to spark development in the state's largest city. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Residents of several roads along the Route 9 corridor near the Port of Wilmington have complained of truck traffic they say hurts their property values and quality of life. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt reports one such street may now get the opportunity to move.
Imagine that at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
I'm standing in the driveway of a house on Piles Lane off Route 9 in Newcastle, watching trucks go by every few minutes. Most turn into Port to Port, an international shipping company with a location right across the street. Behind Port to Port is the Delaware River Industrial Park, and less than a mile away is the Port of Wilmington. Winnie Richards lives a few doors down, and she says members of her family have lived on the street for more than 100 years.
Yeah, that was my grandmother's house. This is my Aunt Mildred's house. This was Mr. Giles' house. That was Zion's house. The house that sits back was my aunt's.
But she says over the decades, the area has changed. In the last few years, truck traffic on her street has made it hard to live there. Winnie's neighbor, Charlie Gonzalez, agrees.
There is a problem with the trucks, because when they do drive past the homes, these houses, they're so close to the road that they start to shake. You know, not really bad, like an earthquake or anything like that, but still, it's annoying that, you know, you have to rearrange your little picture frames and your figurines that you have on your tables.
Now Winnie, Charlie, and their neighbors may get the chance to sell their houses to the state and move away. This year's bond bill signed by Governor John Carney last month quietly authorizes and encourages DelDOT to purchase the 10 residential parcels along Piles Lane closest to Pigeon Point Road at fair market price. A DelDOT spokesperson says the department will go through its normal process to acquire land as laid out in state code. The department says it does not yet know how much a buyout of the parcels would cost, but is required to offer fair market value for them and will not force residents to sell. According to county tax records, most of the houses were built in the 1920s and sit on roughly a quarter of an acre each. The online real estate company Zillow prices most of the properties at between $60,000 and $100,000. State Representative Frank Cook says he has received complaints about the trucking from his constituents on Piles Lane. He's meeting with DelDOT and other elected officials to plan how the potential buyouts would work. He chalks the conflict on Piles Lane up to industrial zone land much too close to residential.
That zoning got in, not thinking about the people around it. It's a huge mistake made by government of letting that be next to housing, that type of economic development. And how do we make up for that mistake? That boggles me every night.
Cook sees it as infeasible to kick out the industry or downzone the industrial land, noting the jobs involved and the planned expansion at the Port of Wilmington by the company now operating it, Gulftainer. In a statement, Gulftainer says it is aware of the dealt out buyout option and is, quote, very pleased, unquote, the state is taking a proactive approach to the residents' concerns. County Councilwoman Janet Kilpatrick sees industrial operations as possibly playing a role in buying out adjacent residents.
So that it wouldn't always be the government that has to buy it, but we could have some sort of private-public partnership going.
And she says if the residents of Piles Lane sell their properties, the county should step in to correct a small piece of the zoning problem in the area by keeping Piles Lane parcels open space.
If that happens, then the county needs to come in. We need to proactively rezone that and guarantee that there is a buffer between Piles Lane and what would be the next street in Hamilton Park behind the Piles Lane people to guarantee that this won't happen again.
Bad zoning is also a theme of the Route 9 corridor master plan completed by the Wilmington Area Planning Council 2 years ago. It prompted the county to survey residents of Eden Park Gardens and Hamilton Park, which includes Piles Lane, on their perceptions of environmental burdens caused by nearby industry and their desire to relocate. Roughly half of residents in these neighborhoods indicated they would be likely to move away if given fair value for their homes or financial assistance. Pastor Lewis McDuffie, president of the Eden Hamilton Park Civic Association, has advocated for relocation for years. He sees DelDOT's authorization to purchase the parcels on Piles Lane as good news for his efforts to secure buyouts for the larger community.
Not only does it help it, it clears the way for the state to become involved in other things. Not only that, it gets out some more people.
But McDuffie says fair market value would not be the appropriate compensation. In discussions with the county about the concept of relocation, he says he's advocated for funding likely above market value that would allow residents to move to equivalent homes in a similarly low-crime area, but without the environmental burdens.
We would need to have the value sufficient to replace what we already have. No violence, zero violence, opportunity for the children. That can't be accomplished by those terms.
For Charlie Gonzalez, the decision to sell would be a hard one. According to tax parcel records, he bought his home more than 30 years ago for $22,000. He says he has invested around $400,000 into the property since then through renovations and improvements. He says he loved his once quiet street and the view of the Christina River from the end of it. And he's retired.
For me, I wasn't planning on moving out of here. Until all of this came along. So now they kind of put me between a rock and a hard place. So I have to make a decision. And if the price is right, then I will make that decision because I'm afraid to go into another neighborhood. I don't know how I'm going to be treated there. I don't know. It's an unknown for me. It's terrifying to have to just uproot to go somewhere else, and then your neighbors might not be like these neighbors are. We're like a family back here.
Winnie Richards says when local elected officials raised the idea of a buyout at a community meeting last year, she did not want to sell her house. But in the months since, her thoughts have begun to change.
This is a thoroughfare between Newcastle Avenue and Pigeon Point Road, and it's always going to be that way. So I'll give up my house that I love so much and my brand new garage, and my brand new $6,850 driveway, and my brand new shed, but they're going to have to pay for it.
Whether and how much the state might pay for the houses on Piles Lane remains to be seen. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. And The Green continues in just a moment with reaction from local lawmakers to last weekend's mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, and their impact on the debate over gun control legislation. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The country was jolted last weekend by mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, that killed 31 people and injured dozens more. And in the wake of those shootings, conversations about guns and stricter laws regulating them re-intensified, along with discussions about white nationalism and its role in fueling violence. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller spoke this week with Governor John Carney, Senator Tom Carper, and Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester to get their thoughts on these latest mass shootings, the future of gun control legislation at the state and federal level, and white nationalism.
Senator Tom Carper issued a statement Monday after President Donald Trump addressed the weekend shootings. Carper said he was praying for the victims and saw Trump's call to close background check loopholes as a good first step. Carper and Senator Chris Coons want Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to bring the Senate back into session this month to vote on the background check bill the House passed earlier this year. but Carper is pessimistic that that will happen.
I don't think it's likely that Mitch McConnell is going to call the Senate back to do anything. And there's a term that's being used, a legislative graveyard, for a lot of legislation, much of it very thoughtful. Legislation is not far left, is not far right. It's just good practical legislation.
Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester says House members are already discussing additional pieces of legislation.
We're also very much concerned about banning these assault weapons in addition to ammunition. You know, there's no reason that a hunter or, you know, someone who is doing recreational, you know, hunting would need that kind of artillery. And so you will see from the House, we're looking at a few things. We're looking at the bills that we currently put forward for the Senate, and we're waiting for them to take action on. We're also, again, we will be proposing, again, the assault weapons ban.
Blunt Rochester says House members will also focus on domestic terrorism and white nationalism. The accused El Paso shooter posted statements online calling immigrants a, quote, invasion, and espousing other anti-immigrant rhetoric. Law enforcement is also examining whether the gunman who shot three people last month at the Garlic Festival in Gilroy, California, was a white nationalist or had other ideological motivations. Blunt Rochester says she's concerned about a rise in hate, bullying, and white nationalism. She's aware of the recent theft of the historical marker installed in the memory of lynching victim George White. George White was a black man who was dragged from a Price's Corner area workhouse and burned alive by a white mob in 1903. Blunt Rochester says her first reaction to that theft was to reach out to Savannah Shepherd, the 16-year-old who led the effort to have that marker installed. A post about the George White historical marker on the Delaware Gun Rights Facebook page drew various comments. The post includes a picture of Blunt Rochester, Coons, and State Senator Brown. While some of the comments have been deleted, members call them Nazis, communists, and call for some of them and other state government officials to be lynched. Mitch Denham is president of Delaware Gun Rights. He says the comments were inappropriate and don't represent the group as a whole.
We are not in any way, shape, or form interested in any way of coming across as hateful or any of that stuff, because that's not what we are. It's not what we're about. The whole purpose of Delaware Gun Rights is to advocate for people to go to legislative hall and participate in the legislative process.
Governor John Carney also voiced concerns about the tone surrounding race and religion. But with school starting at the end of the month, he's also looking pragmatically at the issue of public safety and school security.
We're prepared for the unthinkable. I've been talking actually prior to the incidents with our Secretary of Safety and Homeland Security about some of the issues around school safety. And, you know, we've had school shootings, which is a concern, these mass shootings. It's really hard to prepare for something like that. But our law enforcement agencies are vigilant. We have some special programs that are confidential that are going on to look at targets at risk, if you will.
Carney wants state lawmakers to move forward on gun control bills they shelved this year. Those measures sought to ban assault-style weapons and high-capacity magazines and even create a permit process to buy firearms. Denham opposed these ideas. He considers the shootings more of a mental health issue and not the fault of guns, which he sees as tools in the hands of unstable people. Sarah Stowens with Moms Demand Action Delaware was with gun control activists from across the country for a conference in D.C. last weekend when she heard about Saturday's El Paso mass shooting. After participating in a protest in front of the White House Saturday night, she woke Sunday to the news out of Dayton. Stowens is urging state lawmakers to pass gun control legislation come January. She says they're in a good position right now to strengthen current bills next year or see what other legislation is introduced. No matter what the resistance comes, from gun right advocates.
I think that when the conversation starts with not one inch, I don't know how I move forward from there. But I also think that there are people in our state and around the country who own guns and are and like shooting guns and like owning guns, and they should continue to be able to do that. I just want to have a reasonable conversation about how we can stop the violence.
While state action isn't expected until January when the legislature reconvenes, federal movement is possible in September. Sarah Mueller, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And there's more to come on The Green, including a look at what the escalating trade war between the United States and China could mean for your wallet when you head out to the store. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Trade tensions between the United States and China are escalating in the wake of President Donald Trump announcing new 10% tariffs on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods, and China devaluing its currency and pulling out of U.S. agriculture purchases in response. Much of the reporting on the impact of these tariffs, including some of our own, has focused on farmers like those growing soybeans here in Delaware, or on the stock market. But the longer the trade war goes on, the more everyday consumers will also feel the impact when they head to the store. This week, contributor Eileen Dalabrida took some time to look at the implications for your wallet, and her piece on that is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to discuss it. So, Eileen, the key issue here is that U.S. tariffs on China mean goods made there could ultimately cost more to make. Why is that?
Well, it just adds an extra layer of costs into the system. If you have to pay more, if you have to pay an additional tax, like a tax on gasoline or anything else, it gets passed along ultimately to the consumer.
And you know that this impacts a lot of different companies, including major retailers people shop at all the time, and some familiar tech companies. Who is affected by tariffs like this, and why?
Well, dollar store chains, things like that, they're heavily dependent upon goods made in China. They're really going to take it on the chin. And also department stores and sellers of apparel. Apparel is going to be a big factor because so much apparel is made in China, far more than in Mexico or Vietnam or Bangladesh or any of the other places that American companies manufacture clothing. Plus, if they make more sophisticated clothing in China, they can easily outsource things like undies and simple tops to other places. But American manufacturers are turning to China and have relied on China for that infrastructure that creates the more sophisticated goods.
I found it interesting, you know, that some, though, like Nike, might be somewhat immune from this. Why is that?
Well, Nike does about 30% of its business in manufacturing with China. And so they will have a tariff burden, but they are one of those brands that people will pay extra for. So analysts don't see them as suffering too much from this, that people will just pony up a little bit more for their footwear. It's kind of like those brands that never discount, like Viking appliances and things like that. They are immune from a lot of these pressures.
And going back to what you said about apparel, you also point out that there are some products people might be surprised to hear could face issues under this situation, including, of all things, wedding dresses. Explain that.
Well, the Chinese have wooed and won American producers of bridal attire, and they have invested in the infrastructure needed to produce that. They have air-conditioned factories, so the hands of seamstresses don't perspire on these delicate, mostly white fabrics. They have trained embroiderers and beaters, and those kinds of skills and those kinds of facilities are not easy to find anywhere else in Asia or other places that they that American companies look for to manufacture these types of garments.
Is there a way for some companies to mitigate these issues that they face, whether they be apparel or whether they be TVs and other tech type of items? Can they simply just produce these products elsewhere and avoid this tariff burden?
Well, regardless of where Americans manufacture goods, Americans are very entrepreneurial business people. So they have been mitigating the damages first by just reducing their margins a little bit, just dinging their profits a little bit. Also, they've been looking for more ways to squeeze waste out of the system to get those costs down a little bit more. And then finally, we have the passing things along to the consumer that we're trying to rein that in. It's something that we probably will see when we hit the holiday shopping season. But for now, they're trying very hard to contain costs and to raise them as low as possible.
I was going to say, I mean, that there is another, I guess, possible fallout from all this is as it becomes harder and harder for those companies to avoid passing the cost on to consumers, that could lead to a drop in consumer confidence. And as you mentioned, you know, as we look ahead to the holiday shopping season, are there some serious implications in that area if this trade war kind of lingers on for another few months?
The analysts are upping their predictions of recession within the next 12 months to 50%. That's from Moody's Analytics, which is based in Westchester. And that was 35% risk only a month ago. I think that Americans are just not used to tariff wars. Historically, tariffs were a very important part of our economy before we had income tax. At one time, when our country was very young, it provided 95% of our income. It was the first bill passed after we ratified the Constitution. The bill was written by James Madison and signed by George Washington. But tariffs have not been as effective in recent years. They were, Herbert Hoover signed a big tariff bill into effect in 1930, the very beginning of the Great Depression, and it only made things worse. So tariffs are a sticky wicket and not something that we're used to dealing with on such a massive scale in recent history.
And I imagine that's a lot of what goes into the issues that we see on the stock market. It makes investors very, very nervous. But how nervous, you know, are companies in the retail realm at this juncture? And how concerned should consumers be as we look forward and as, you know, if this does in fact continue on again for another few months without any kind of real resolution?
Retailers are not happy about this. Their stock is getting crushed. Their profit margins are getting squeezed, and they have been pretty tight as it is. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this progresses, whether or not the Trump administration backs down a bit on tariffs, whether consumers rein it in, because we've been so accustomed to these deep discounts and these very good prices that it's like, hey, how come we have to pay more? We're not used to this. We don't know how it's going to play out, but it's going to be very interesting, and it's going to be unfolding within the next few months.
I was going to say, is it fair to say that the rubber could really hit the road at the holiday season?
This is it. That is when the rubber hits the road.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. Again, her piece on trade tensions between the U.S. and China and what they mean for the retail world is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And coming up, our latest arts playlist, which looks ahead to the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's new season. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra kicks off its 2019-2020 season of concerts in Wilmington next month. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Delaware Symphony Orchestra Executive Director Alan Jordan, who offers a preview of the season, which he says will feature performances covering a variety of periods and composers.
All right, Alan, big news. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra will be starting its new concert season in September. Tell me all about it.
Well, it's our 114th season. I'm not sure what the anniversary present is for that. And it is the 17th anniversary for David Amato as music director.
Wow.
So it's an exciting time for us. We have recently announced our Wilmington-based activities. We have a five-concert classic series, all at the Copeland Hall and the Grand Opera House, and then a four-concert chamber series over at the Gold Ballroom of the Hotel DuPont. The classic series is full orchestra performances beginning in September. We're going to open the season by awarding our annual Alfred I. DuPont Award for a living composer, and Missy Mazzoli will be coming. Missy is New York City-based. But I think her latest project is she's writing an opera for the Metropolitan Opera. So she's a fantastic composer, and we're going to open the season with her work called Symphonia for Orbiting Spheres. Then we bring Tessa Lark, the wonderful young violinist, out to perform the violin concerto by Samuel Barber, our neighbor from Westchester. And then we close that program with the Dvorak Symphony No. 8. In November, we're doing a program of Ravel, Beethoven and Nielsen, the Beethoven Third Piano Concerto with the wonderful young pianist Michael Brown, and Eric Nielsen's Symphony No. 5. January is opens with Borodin's Overture to Prince Igor. Then we're going to perform the Elgar Cello Concerto with Camille Thomas, who comes over from Paris to perform for us. And we close that program with Rachmaninoff's First Symphony. In March, yet another young soloist, Anthony McGill, principal clarinet of the New York Philharmonic and also a member of the ensemble that performed at Mr. Obama's first inauguration a while back. We're going to close that program with Holst's Planets, and Anthony's going to perform Mozart's clarinet concerto. Finally, in May, we close the season as appropriate, because next year is going to be a celebration of Beethoven's 250th birthday, so we will be performing the Symphony No. 9, the Choral Symphony, with the University of Delaware Symphonic Choir.
All right, we're talking to Alan Jordan, the Executive Director of the Delaware Symphony Orchestra, the DSO, pleased to announce its 2019-2020 season, beginning on September 27th at 7:30 at the Grand in Wilmington. The opening concert is what I'm most excited about. What's the opening concert?
So Missy Mazzoli is going to be here to receive the Alfred I. DuPont Award for a living American composer. And we're going to open the concert with her work, Symphonia. Then Tessa Lark, who's this wonderful MacArthur Foundation Award-winning violinist, will perform Samuel Barber's violin concerto. And then the second half will be Dvorak's wonderful Symphony No. 8. It's just a happy, ebullient symphony, and we're looking forward to opening the season with that.
Now, Dan messaged me and said the opening concert is Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, you know what? That was the title that David gave it. I think having to do with the Dvorak and the Barber also having some folk sound to it. I'm sorry if you were thinking Queen was going to be there.
I really was. See, now I'm let down. No, I'm just kidding. This is all still so exciting. Talk to me, if you will. How is it decided on each and every year, Alan, who will be performing and what the season will shape up to look like at the Delaware Symphony every season?
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things that we do is we look towards anniversaries of composers or performances of works, premieres, things like that. And so we knew that Beethoven's 250th was coming up. Now, that's happening as we're actually doing a survey of all the major Beethoven works. But so we decided that we were definitely going to have the Ninth Symphony next season. I think we look at a combination of soloists that are on our list, our wish list. We have a very long wish list of soloists. And so we start with soloists and work on that repertoire, and then add the major work on the concert, the symphony in most cases. And it really is it's a number of factors. I mean, we want to offer variety. I mean, we only do five programs, so it's kind of difficult to get everything in. But you want to have a variety of periods, you know, classical, romantic, contemporary. You want to have a variety of nationalities represented. You know, you could easily do a whole season of German music, but you want to have some French music. You want to have some British music. You certainly want to feature some American music and Russian music. So it's like putting a puzzle together, I think. You have a whole bunch of different pieces, and you just need to see how they fit, and you see how they fit together, too. How, you know, a concerto would work well or not so well with a certain symphony. There's a little bit of art to it. There's a little bit of just, you know, what you want to hear and what you want to present. And there's also the combination of offering really familiar works and some that maybe are less familiar with the audience, because I think our audiences really do appreciate being exposed to stuff that they haven't heard before.
Yeah, and you must have great audiences. I mean, the Delaware Symphony Orchestra, you started off this conversation by saying this is the 114th season. So the audience must be great for the DSO.
It is. It is. I don't think we have many from the original year anymore, but it's an audience that really sticks with us. I mean, we have five busloads of people that come from the senior communities in the area, Stonegate, Kendall, those places. But then we also have young families coming. And I do think that the audience really kind of feeds off of seeing the multi-generations. And it's a great progression. I mean, I think one of the reasons that our audiences are growing is that our fans who have been with us, you know, since their 50s, are now still with us in their 80s and 90s. And at the same time, we've got younger people, couples and families coming in who will start their progression.
Where can we get more information about the new season, again, which kicks off on September 27th? So people have plenty of time to get information, plenty of time to purchase their tickets. If they want to read up on all the shows you've just told us about, all the performances, where can they do that?
But everything is listed on our website. That's at www.DelawareSymphony.org, spelled all out in lowercase letters.
Thanks to Delaware Symphony Orchestra Executive Director Alan Jordan and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And stay with us. We wrap up the green with Enlighten Me and a closer look at the newly formed Wilmington Alliance and how it intends to pursue developing and revitalizing the state's largest city. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Two groups working to promote growth and revitalization throughout Wilmington announced this week they are joining forces. The new Wilmington Alliance brings together the Wilmington Renaissance Corporation and the Wilmington Leaders Alliance. The Renaissance Corporation, originally known as Wilmington 2000, has been around since 1993 and worked on projects such as development of the Loma District and launch of the Creative District. The Leaders Alliance started in 2015, bringing business, civic, and nonprofit leaders together with a focus on initiatives like workforce development and teen violence intervention. What will the new organization look like, and what will it do that the two groups weren't doing already independently? In this week's Enlighten Me, we put those questions and more to Christiana Care Chief Transformation Officer, Dr. Edmundo Robinson, the incoming vice chair of the Wilmington Alliance, starting with what prompted the two groups to come together.
We had two really strong organizations One with, you know, Wilmington Renaissance Corporation, a little bit more history there, but still two very strong organizations. But their missions were quite similar. There was a significant amount of overlap. There are also some areas where they were different, but there's a significant amount of overlap. And you know, Delaware's a small place. Wilmington, we can kind of wrap our arms around, you know, the folks that are truly trying to drive change in the city. And we really, quite frankly, the leaders got together and said, you know, I think it makes more sense. It makes better sense for us to work together on this. And really, like Terry DuPont said, you know, really kind of this idea of 1+1=3, by bringing the organization together, really trying to drive the change for the city in a significant way.
With that 1+1=3 model in mind, are there some things you see this new group being able to do that the other two couldn't accomplish independently?
So, you know, there were things that that each group was doing that we're going to bring to bear that are consistent with, you know, each individual group. But the one piece is a real focus on economic development. That's going to be somewhat new. And the other piece that I'm going to bring to the table with my leadership is really a rather specific focus on addressing the social determinants of health. And I'm really gonna kind of hold management close and accountable around focusing on that and really articulating how we're driving change and improvements in the health of the city of Wilmington.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into that idea of social determinants of health. Tell us a little bit about, you know, from your perspective, what does that look like? What are you talking about when you're talking about social determinants of health, and how can the Wilmington Alliance address that issue?
So social determinants of health are really critical. Well, I happen to be a health services researcher, and one of the things that we've learned really clearly is that health care, the services and interventions that we deliver as doctors, for example, as providers, is really a small, relatively small facet or percentage of your overall health of an individual or even a community. The overall health of an individual community is really driven by other factors that are much ultimately more important. So think of things like education levels, transportation, employment, and these are what we find are these are drivers that truly impact your health. And so what we found on the healthcare delivery side is that we actually do have to address these concerns if we're truly trying to improve the health of a population. So where Wilmington Alliance is quite well positioned is that these are areas that they've already have been working on and working in for quite some time. They may not have articulated it as addressing social determinants of health, but again, with me with my doctor hat on, I'm thinking that's what they're doing, even if folks didn't realize that's what they were doing, right? So if you think about, you know, addressing things like affordable housing and placemaking at artists, you know, what they're doing around a creative district, right? So now you're actually allowing, being able to have affordable housing is really a big driver as well. So though that kind of work is really critical, and Christiana Care has been very supportive of that, both not just with my attendance as part of the board in the board leadership, but really in other areas, whether it be in legal areas or in other areas, in terms of really kind of helping to drive the social determinants.
You mentioned the Creative District, and I know, you know, looking at these two organizations, they have worked on a wide variety of projects and initiatives over the year, things ranging from the Creative District to workforce development. Are there some particular ones that the new organization is going to continue focusing on that they've kind of made priorities to kind of keep moving the ball forward on?
Yeah, so the Creative District is definitely a big one, I think they listed even in the presentation yesterday, there were several components within that Creative District. Mm-hmm. I think the concept, though, so whether it's the Art-O-Mat or the kitchen and so forth, but the concept of building out and place making in that way is actually scalable and applicable to other parts of the city. And so what's the power again of this alliance is that we can now start to scale the successes and learnings from a project like Creative District and start to target other components of the parts of the city in collaboration with the mayor and the city council in terms of, you know, kind of understanding strategic priorities. And now we can really start to spread those interventions with again my focus on truly understanding the outcomes from that investment, from those interventions.
And certainly there also, you mentioned the health side of it, but also those type of things as they're kind of moved from one place to another, from say a creative district to maybe another area of the city, that also winds up being a real factor in economic development, right?
That's absolutely right. Right. So part of what we're looking at is what does it mean to recruit, attract, retain, kind of a commercial business, and so we're doing some of that work in the kind of Market Street area, and that's exactly right. So once you start to remake a given area from a placemaking perspective, you have so many other options and opportunities to drive economic development within that area. And it's really important. This is not this idea of gentrification, right? So the creative district, you've got artists, it's really kind of affordable, but you're really driving improvement without driving out those folks that have been there for decades around, and have really developed a community. It's important to not just to keep those folks there, but actually have them be a part of the solutions that are being developed.
One of the big issues that faces any effort to kind of develop, revitalize, improve a city like Wilmington is follow through. Some ideas and projects launch with great fanfare, then at times they struggle to reach critical mass or just stall altogether. Is this new group better equipped, do you think, better positioned to keep the ball rolling on projects and initiatives and make sure that they wind up having the intended impact that they launched with?
That's a really, really important question. So, the Wilmington Renaissance Corporation on that side, that they've got decades of follow-through around this. What's the opportunity here when it's a private, nonprofit community-based organization like the Wilmington Alliance is that, it can see things through, even through different kind of political times and turmoil and different things that might be going on externally, but it can see a project through. That's one factor. Another component answer to that question is what I've been stressing as well, which is understanding your metrics and your outcomes, right? So if you're going to invest in these kinds of interventions that are truly looking to drive economic development, make sure you can measure what it is that you're trying to accomplish more specifically, so that you have those data. You can go back to your investors and say, hey, these are the changes that we've actually made. You should actually continue investing and supporting in this work. But the third piece is the investors themselves, right? So what Wilmington Renaissance and Wilmington Leaders Alliance were both really strong at. It was just had a really great support throughout the city with large companies, smaller companies, but really great support. And so that support has continued and even expanded in cases with the new Wilmington Alliance. So, you've got the financial, underpinnings and investment in this work. You've got the metrics that you're gonna leverage to understand what you're doing, and you've got the wherewithal to see these projects through. I think that's a great combination of resources to get this work done.
Now, I imagine the metrics piece of it is also really important when you talk about, as we were earlier, duplicating these things elsewhere.
Right, exactly, right. So, that's really important. So once you, not every area that you might do this kind of work in has the same needs. But if you've identified a need that's similar to an area where you've already done work, then you absolutely can say, hey, is this replicable in this area? Let's go do it and let's go measure it, because we know based on our metrics that we have done this work and it has had the outcomes, the desired outcomes. So that's actually, it is really important for being able to scale.
And clearly to be part of an effort like this, an organization like this, you kind of need to be inherently bullish about the city and its prospects.
Yes.
What makes you believe in Wilmington and its potential?
Oh, it's a great little city. So, you're in a place where, you're well positioned just geographically. Obviously, you're right on 95, you're right on the Amtrak train line. You've got SEPTA right into Philly and so forth as well. So just geographically well positioned, it's a small enough city where you can really wrap your arms around it and understand where the neighborhoods are and where options and opportunities are from a living and from working and for playing. But you've also you've got some of those big city resources, whether it's the arts, whether it's the nightlife scene and I'm a foodie, so it's got the restaurant front. So you've got all those resources. Again, me from a business leader perspective, you know, you can talk to your city council. You know, they're right there. They're right on the neighborhoods with you, right on the blocks with you, really supporting. Their districts. You can have conversations with the mayor and their staff, and so it's not this massive place where you feel like your voice is not heard. Your voice absolutely is heard. So you have an opportunity. It's like a really great mix of big city and small town at the same time in a wonderful location. I think it's absolutely positioned for success.
Thanks to ChristianaCare Chief Transformation Officer Dr. Edmundo Robinson, incoming Vice Chair of the Wilmington Alliance, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Eileen Dalabrito, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Muir, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.